You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
Brian Denson is the author of The Spy Son,
a true story of the highest-ranking Central Intelligence Agency officer ever convicted of espionage and the son he trained to spy for Russia.
Brian's currently working on a series of four books for younger readers based on FBI case files.
I'm Gregory Day with the Weekly Portland Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
The Spy Son focuses on Jim Nicholson, who convinced his son Nathan to sell secrets to the Russians, even as he sat behind bars in an Oregon prison. We talk more about the book today and how it's affected Brian's life personally since its release, as well as his new projects. So we're going to take a trip to Southwest Portland today to chat with the author at his home.
My goal writing The Spy Son was to write this generation's Falcon and the Snowman, because it involved a young guy betraying his country, in Nathan's case, for very different motives than Chris Boyce and Dalton Lee.
I love the way the book began with the courthouse.
I mean, it was career-changing for me because I was covering the federal courts against my will. I had been working on the investigative team. The investigative team got blown up, and they cast us to the four corners of the newsroom, and I wound up covering the federal courts. Here I am sitting in this courtroom when this life-changing story shows up. I would say this story is certainly in the pantheon of five really great stories that have come across my transom over 30 some years. Where the CIA reassigns Jim Nicholson when he fell under investigation. And of course, Jim doesn't know he's under investigation. They reassign him to this counterterrorism center, right? Which is like a fortress behind a fortress behind a fortress inside of a fortress, right? Mm-hmm. And the FBI couldn't get in there. Nobody could get in there but the cleaning crew and the people who work there. And so they had to have an inside guy. And so McGuire becomes the first and only CIA officer ever to go literally spy versus spy under the roof at Langley. I mean, that's just not done. And he was the eyes and ears of the FBI working, very closely with the Bureau.
Boy, this character of Jim Nicholson, you must have really tried to get inside this man's head. What a scary place to be.
Well, it is. I mean, and, I still have questions about the motivation.
And what was fascinating was even Jim didn't really grasp his own motivation at times.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And in his one, he wrote two letters to me, but one of them really touched on that and the fact that he didn't have all the answers.
I remember
about
that.
Why he did what he did.
These photocopied letters you received.
Yeah. Jim's an intriguing character. I actually labored under the misapprehension for some time that Jim was a psychopath, meaning that he had no conscience
right.
at all. And I get to this at the end of the book. I don't want to give too much away. But he had
some
many
traits.
Of the characteristics of a psychopath, but ultimately the two psychiatrists I spoke to said, no, not quite, but close. And folks can read about that, I suppose.
On your Think Out Loud interview, you mentioned some Russian spies. This was a case, I believe, in 2016.
Yeah.
You were interviewed as an expert.
Right.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Jan and Victoria Newman were what they call walk-ins. They were both with the FSB, the Federal Security Service that followed the KGB, the domestic security service in Russia.
So like the FBI.
Yes, exactly like the FBI, except a little more ruthless and corrupt and operating unlawfully all the time. This couple, she wound up going through the program, what they call KGB High School, and then decided not to pursue a career. But she and Jan, the husband, married, and he stayed in and was, you know, working with Russia's banks. There is this, you know, sort of criminal, I don't know how you pronounce it, I think it's Cerberus, you know, a three-headed monster of the FSB, the mafia, and the banks. And it's all about money laundering and making Vladimir Putin very, very wealthy. And so this guy got in trouble working. He went to work for one of the banks after he sort of went on reserve status with the FSB. And he gets a call from his boss one day. And he says, come to my house. And he says, I'll try to get there at the next hour. He goes, there's a car waiting for you. Which is not good news for this former FSB guy. And he shows up. The guy says, you have three choices. You can be an officer, which is Russian slang for kill yourself, or you can
fall on your own sword.
Yeah, exactly. Or you can wait for somebody to come do it for you, put a bullet in your head, or you can run like hell. And that's exactly what he did.
It's nice to give him that choice to run.
Yeah, I thought it was too. You know, maybe there is some honor among thieves. An espionage investigation is not always a criminal investigation. Espionage investigations, most of them never come to the public's attention.
That's they are sort of quietly resolved. Yeah. Yes, they have to be,
and,
essentially.
You know, of course, in the present day case, we
it benefits both sides to get this resolved under the table.
But at a certain so an espionage team in the FBI will be working to develop what they call a predicate. Right. And that predicate is that the person has actually betrayed the country to a foreign government. And at that point, it jumps into a criminal investigation. And I think
there has to be overwhelming evidence.
There has to be overwhelming evidence to convict. I don't know that there has to be overwhelming evidence to begin a criminal investigation. I think it has to pass muster at the Department of Justice and a certain team of FBI agents who, you know, have top secret security clearances, go in and have those conversations about what they've you know developed. But you know, I don't want to give the book away, but you know, there is a moment or two or three where, you know, it's pretty obvious to the team they had a spy on their hands, and he worked under the roof at Langley. You know,
I mean, they had to dig and get more proof, and I mean DNA samples, and catch him basically in the act.
Yeah, that whole arrest operation is so, I mean, it was like writing a movie script.
Yeah, so surreal, almost.
You know, I mean, they had a couple of agents, you know, standing up, trying to get, you know, behind Jim so that he couldn't run away. You know, couldn't go back into the terminal, and you know, and they had to perform a ruse. They got into an argument. You know, they started screaming at each other, and Jim finally passed them, and you know, went onto the tarmac. But it's a gripping scene, and Jim was absolutely astonished that he was caught, which tells you a lot, I think, about Jim.
You know, we're talking a lot about Jim, but you know, I do want to get to Nathan because he is really the focus of the latter part of this book.
Yes,
and you've developed a relationship with, or you did develop a relationship with Nathan.
Yes.
In the course of this book. And you talk about this in the epilogue. You got involved. You got involved. And emotionally.
It's impossible to spend a couple of hundred hours with a young man who had gone through so much like that, had been worked over like a garden variety foreign asset by his own father. It would be impossible not to develop a sadness for what became of him. And there's a certain point in the book where I talk about, you know, this sort of orthodoxy in American journalism that says that you have to always keep objectivity, and you know, and it's a bunch of horse crap. The truth is, all you have to really do as a journalist is tell the truth. If you tell the truth and you get the story, you know, all is well. In this case, I got very close to Nathan. Today, I call him a friend. I went hiking with him a couple months ago. He is a fundamentally decent, but by his own acknowledgement, a very naive young guy who really, really trusted his dad, and trusted his dad at a time when he was at his most vulnerable, for reasons that people can read in the book, and even at one point suicidal. And his father cultivated that. There was a ruthlessness to that, you know, as I came to understand it, and it took me a while to fully grasp it, and I think Nathan is still trying to grasp it. It was the meanest thing I've ever seen a father do, you know. I developed a particular fondness for Nathan at a certain point. But, you know, I tell what he really did. I mean, you know, he broke the law on a number of different occasions, and he betrayed his country. About 5 months ago, 4 months ago, my agent called from New York, and she said, would you consider writing a series of stories, true stories about the FBI for kids? I was like, what? And she said, no, hear me out. And I said, I'm listening. She said, we're trying to develop strong nonfiction for what we call middle grade readers. And I said, oh, you got to enlighten me. What is a middle grade reader? And she said, well, it's, you know, readers anywhere from like 6 to 15. It's kind of a, you know, broad segment, but it gets defined by the publishers a little more closely. And I said, well, I'd have to think about that. And I wasn't thinking about it at all.
You told me about this. I thought that I misheard you.
No, and I had never written for kids, although I'd written in Houston, and, you know, like one in three people there English is a second language, and so I was always writing in short, punchy sentences, you know, and I have continued to do that, although in this book I got a little longer. But so I said, let me think about that, and I didn't really have much thought about it. How would I do that, and what would I write about? And she said, oh, and there's one other thing. We want the protagonists to be, you know, not just a bunch of white males. And I, you know, burst out laughing because, you know, the FBI is what, like 83% is white and male, right? And so I was like, yeah, I just don't know if that's possible. Let me think about it. And before she got off the phone, she said, well, you know, let me tell you this. The advances are very good and the royalties can be extraordinary. And I said, you now have my undivided attention. So I signed the contract about 2 weeks ago, and I'm finishing the book this week. The first one is you're going to laugh. It's a children's book about the Unabomber.
This is what I thought that I misheard. This can't be a thing.
True. Yeah,
this is a thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's on my screen. Well, it's not on my screen now because the screen went blank. But it's the story of Ted Kaczynski as told from the point of view of the investigators who took nearly 17 years to catch the guy.
Now, you mentioned right at the beginning of this book, the Unabomber.
I actually sat through Ted Kaczynski's arraignment in federal court in Helena, Montana, way back in 1996.
Really? And you were reporting?
I mean, I was sitting as far from him as I am from you right now. There was nothing between us
really?
But a little railing there. I was in the front court of the front seat
Ted
of the courtroom.
Ted Kaczynski, oh my goodness.
You know, he looked so meek and mild. I was absolutely convinced that the government had it wrong. I thought, there's no way this guy was a bomber. And then I later found out, no, bombers are actually really cowardly. You know, I mean, they're sending things through the mail. They're dropping things off. And, you know, and Ted Kaczynski's kind of the ultimate coward, honestly.
And you're making that more palatable for a younger audience? I don't know how you do that.
Well, I'm leaving out things like the fact that Ted Kaczynski wrote in his in his journals that he was able to pleasure himself orally, And yeah, I've left things like that. I've left out, you know, the bits and pieces of people smattered against walls and things like that. But I've got it just exciting enough where kids will be riveted, I think. We'll find out. I hope they'll be riveted and not riveted to the point that they're barfing. You know, I'm trying to avoid that part.
So this is a series?
It will be a series. Yeah, the first four books I just signed
the deal for. No Jeffrey Dahmer book planned, right?
No Jeff Dahmer book. And no Gary Michael Heidnik book. He was even worse than Dahmer, I think. No, the first four books would be the Unabomber. I'm writing the story of George Pirro, who was the guy who interrogated Saddam Hussein, the FBI agent who interrogated Saddam Hussein. A third one is about the Aldrich Ames spy case from the point of view of the case agent, a guy named Les Wiser. And then the fourth one is a very cool book that I'm going to keep to myself for right now, just because I haven't talked to the protagonist yet, who has already told me he's willing to do it, but I haven't told him yet.
I love how you ended this book. It really touches on your connection.
There is a point at the end of the book where Nathan overcomes a tremendous amount of obstacles in his life and ultimately meets the woman of his dreams after.
That's right.
The book,
yes.
Discovers, you know, his rather poor... poor success with women prior to that, and comically bad
too, right?
experiences with other women. And so at the end, he is with the woman of his that he'll walk, you know, God willing, to the altar with. I went to the graduation. It was the Saturday before Father's Day. And met with Nathan and watched him cross the stage and all the other. He was in this, you know, this computer engineering program. So there's all these geeky right. kids, you know.
Words, yes.
It was a really kind of a sweet experience, because this is the same college that his mother and father had both attended, and his brother and sister, all of them.
And they met there. They fell in love there also.
Yes. Yeah. In the 1970s. And so. It was a special moment to be there for that. And I decided, as I was actually flying from DC, where I was doing some research with the agency and the bureau, and I came back and I hit town just in time to sweep by a liquor store and buy the ingredients for a couple of rather large scorpion cocktails, which was Nathan's beverage of choice. And I don't have the ingredients right with me, but I know there are two different kinds of rum and some other booze and some other booze and
it
I think some more
awful.
Booze.
It really sounds awful.
It sounds awful, but there's just enough orange juice in it and I think maybe some pineapple juice that it just kind of goes down very smoothly. And I did have one of those, as I say, in Nicosia, Cyprus, there in the TGI Fridays that Nathan Nicholson never went into, but which the FBI did. Again, don't like to be ever a part of the story, but I did open the book because I wanted to tell how I came to be telling the readers this story. And I realized only late in the process that I was going to have to write an epilogue that told, you know, so where that ended up, right. that my feelings about this case. And I think it worked really well. I don't go into first person, but maybe a couple times in the middle of the book and only for comic relief.
That's true.
And it seems to have worked. A lot of people have bought the book or listened on Audible or picked it up on Kindle or picked it up in different countries around the world. And I'm really thrilled by the success of it. I just thank the people out there who took a chance on me to write it. You know, honestly, I'm writing this book series. It's four books. I'm knocking out one every 4 months. And so, you know, in the next year,
cool.
You know, yeah. And the deal paid me enough money that I will be able to survive for a year. So that's a good thing, right?
That's really cool.
So I'll continue to do that. And I've got a big story I'm going to be working on in this, probably in February or March, I'll probably be writing some stories about it in a daily, probably the Los Angeles Times. And then I'll be writing a longer form piece for a major magazine.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It was so much fun talking to you. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. My name is Gregory Day. We will see you next week. Please join me.
Why?
Almost 13 hours, the audiobook, and it flew by. Have you heard this?
I have, and part of that is the guy who read it, Jason Culp. And there's a backstory there that nobody knows. There's a backstory.
Backstory.
Yeah, Jason called me. I didn't know anything about him, but he wanted to know how to pronounce all of the names, you know, in the book. And there are all these Russian names, and I didn't know how to pronounce them. I knew how to spell them, you know. Mm. And so he calls me. And he says, hey, I need these, you know, pronunciations. I said, well, let me see what I can do. So my girlfriend runs a language company. She's the CEO of Certified Languages International. There's a plug. And she has, you know, staff of people who deal with interpreters all day long, you know, thousands and thousands of interpreters. And so she put somebody on the job, and a friend of mine, and ultimately got all the pronunciations. So the guy calls me the next morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. And he says, you know, I really enjoyed the book. It's going to work for me a lot. It's going to be a great read. It's going to be a lot of fun. He said, you know, in a way, I'm kind of the spy's son, too. And I thought, oh, here we go. This guy's, you know, got a tinfoil hat or something, you know. And
Wars.com, right?
I said to him, Jason, what do you mean? And you know, I think that was the operative entry. And he said, well, my father was in a wildly popular television show back in the 60s called I Spy. Well, I knew the show really well. I grew up watching
it. Big show.
Yeah. Robert Culp was his dad. And so he really took a special interest in it, and he has promoted the book. He's been a great guy. And a lot of people really enjoyed the Audible version of the book.
It flew by.